Rientriamo in diretta da Villa Romana, Open Studios 2015, e sta per cominciare il talk, diciamo al cuore della nostra serata qua in diretta su Radio Papesse. Passiamo all'inglese, just a quick switch to English, because we are going to start with the first talk, and while we are going to start, the Schwarmwesen has joined us and we are switching to English because we are going to talk with Judith Traum and Sabet Buchmann about the work, and it's gonna be a pretty long conversation. There will be images projected, and if you are following us online, you can go on the website and look for Judith Traum's, and you will find a selection of the images of which we will be talking about. And all the other who are here with us today are very welcome to join us. There is also a microphone here on the table, an open microphone here on the table, if you want to join us on or talk with Judith or Sabet, please join in and come to the table. It's open for whoever wants to join in. And please come closer. You can use all the space around us. So I think I will just pass the ball to Ilaria and let her introduce the talk of tonight.
Yeah, and Judith is inviting you to watch the projection because it's part of the presentation. So thank you, Judith, and thank you, Sabet, for choosing Radio Papesse to present the Ezer book. You are going to talk about this sort of diary of a long, long research journey Judith made between 2010-2012, maybe longer, in Anatolia, in Turkey, trying to dig into the history of the economical colonialism of Germany into that region during the 19th century. So I give you the word. The mics are open, and thank you for being us with us.
Thanks, Ilaria.
Judith is one of the four fellow artists here at Villa Romana for 2015.
Welcome, everybody. Buonasera. And for those, I think, whoever of you wants to see and be with us, please come closer and maybe sit down in the garden. There are many seats still left, so you can see the projection better. Potete venire qui per vedere la proiezione più bene, se volete.
Thank you, Sabet, for coming. And Sabet is one of the authors in the book which I recently published with Archive Books in Berlin. And I wanted to give you a brief introduction into the topic of my research and also the content of the book. And then Sabet Buchmann and I are going to talk a bit about the specifics of my artistic method. For those of you who are listening to the radio, I selected some photographs which we are also projecting here in the garden, and I will try to describe them in a way that you can follow them online on the website. Let's first look briefly at a map, which is not even part of the book, but I wanted to show it to you so that you have some sense of orientation about the geographical scope of the project. German bankers and engineers built a railway at the end of the 19th century through the Ottoman Empire. It was a commission by the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire needed infrastructure, needed a railway, and they commissioned Deutsche Bank, who is, by the way, also the founder of this nice villa where we are at. They've commissioned Deutsche Bank, who had experience with international projects already at the time, with financing the construction of that railway. I wanted to show you this map also because it gives you a sense of the geography of the area where we are, which is basically the area we have in the news a lot these days because of the happenings in Syria, in Iraq, and the things that ES is doing there. So the Ottoman Empire was in its last decades of existence before it would fall apart after the First World War.
and it was already struggling to keep its provinces together. And the main purpose to build this railroad was actually a military purpose, to be able to move troops more easily. And the second reason, of course, was an economic one. And on the map, you can see the line going on the left corner. On the upper left corner, you have Istanbul, at the time Constantinople. And the line was crossing through nowadays Turkey to the southeast of Turkey and then entering into what is nowadays Syria and what is nowadays Iraq. And it was going down to Baghdad from there. And it was almost finished until the outbreak of World War I. They started building it in 1888. This is when Deutsche Bank got commissioned with it. To give you an idea of the infrastructural endeavor, of course, it was in some sense an engineering project that was heroic, as we know these projects to be, with grand gestures in the landscape, conquering gestures, big structures being built, bridges, tunnels, railway tracks being laid. Everything that was being done was done by German engineers. There was a point in the contract that the Ottoman Empire agreed on with the Deutsche Bank that all engineers working on the project should be German and all material used should be also German, which meant a big import business for German companies. All steel, all machinery, all know-how was basically imported into the Ottoman Empire. What I used as the basis for my research were the archives of Deutsche Bank, of the bank itself. The bank has a large historical archive. The files on the Baghdad and Anatolian Railway are numerous. Many, many files exist. And I was first entering these archives to look for testimonies of resistances in this railway project. Is it possible that people resisted what German engineers and businessmen brought with a mission of culturally renewing the country? Was there resistance? Were there difficulties? Were there unexpected moments within this project of building a railway and modernizing the country? So I wanted to give you an idea with these few images that I selected here of the material I worked with at first hand, which were these historical files, old letters by members of the Deutsche Bank writing to businessmen who they wanted to get into the boat and take part in the project, businessmen writing back to Deutsche Bank saying, oh, this idea sounds good, yes, our business wants to get engaged with you. And what I found out very soon, that the bank, Deutsche Bank, did not stop at building the railroad. For them, it was only interesting to do this if this whole project could be much larger, meaning they wanted to create a corridor for German products to flow into this region, into the Middle Eastern region. The idea, which was clearly formulated in letters, was that the Middle East, the Near East, and even the region up to China were not yet opened up for international trade, and German businessmen saw their big chance coming and thought, we can now enter these countries and sell our products there. So they thought when they built this railroad through nowadays Turkey into nowadays Iraq in the direction of India and China, all these areas will be gained as countries who buy German products and where raw materials, resources can be brought back to the German territory. It was really a task in that sense. It was not the time of open colonialism anymore. Germany did not have many colonies in comparison to Britain and France, so they were somehow pushing towards more influence in this region, but the influence was not an openly political one anymore, no political sovereignty. It was executed with the means of economic endeavors, economic relationships. So the thinking was the same as in classic colonialism, a thinking of Western superiority, a cultural mission that people felt they were doing there, but it was really about selling products and establishing trade routes. So the railway was this corridor to do trade. So one thing which is intriguing that the bankers thought about was agriculture in Anatolia and in the region the railway entered, because it's clear they thought if we manage to modernize agriculture, which they thought was very poor and very simple there, if we modernize agriculture and fruits and crops are growing in great quantities, all of a sudden the railway can transport much more quantities of goods, right? So we can make money with that. And they thought we can guarantee the nutrition of the German population. So agriculture is one chapter in my book. I wanted to give those sources to the public because they are widely unknown. It is well known that Deutsche Bank built the railway, but what is not known is that they influenced the development of Anatolian agriculture in a great deal. They also influenced the archaeology of the country. Several files I studied are on are instructions how the engineers of the railway should actually treat archaeological findings. And a third chapter is the working conditions in the country. Because, of course, the railway, I told you, the railway personnel, people who got engaged to build the railway were mostly European and German. But the great number of simple workers were all people from the Ottoman Empire, of course, the ethnicities that were at the time that the Ottoman Empire consisted of: Armenians, the biggest number, of course, Turks, but also Kurds, Armenians, Georgians, Georgians, people from Greek, from the Balkan regions, Arabs. So there was a very heterogeneous group of people working for very low wages, and the working conditions were bad up to unfair, and this was openly pushed in that way by Deutsche Bank. The book is about these three things: how engineers, businessmen, bankers take hold of a country by influencing agriculture, archaeology, and working conditions. And the interest that I had was really to look at how do they do this, with what kind of spirit do they enter these rearms. And the topic of the research I did after finding out the facts, the research was always about what resistances are there, were there, what moments are or were imaginable that would open up another direction of touching things, of dealing with things, because the way the bankers did it was merely economic principle. Profit, it has to be rational, efficient, the results have to be clear, linear, yeah, the kind of cliches that go with an image we have of modernity. Here's, for example, a drawing by workers that I found in the files while researching working conditions, because those voices of the workers are hardly traceable. Many of them were probably illiterate, could not write or read. In the files, you have an immense amount of letters in a very arrogant language written by the bankers, by the businessmen. You have hardly any material written by the actual subjects in the country. But yeah, in the file about working conditions, the personnel, it happened that I could find some material, some letters, some drawings, which are rare findings and which the people in the archive did not even know about, that they were in these files. So I'm glad to be able to bring them to light and have them all in the book also. So the first part of my research was to go and find sources in the archives, written sources and photographs, and you find them in the book really quoted extensively. The letters that I thought were most interesting, I'm quoting almost fully, and have them translated into English and Turkish, so that from the German files, by translating them in another language, a bigger audience can have access to these facts. The second part of the research was to go to the country and see if I can find traces of what I found in the archives and what I thought must have existed on site, if I can find traces of that in nowadays circumstances. How does the material world along the railway tracks look like nowadays? Did this mania of efficiency and control leave specific traces in the material, in the gestures, in the ways things are being done around the railroad? This was my mission when I went along the railway tracks for three times in three different years. And I'm just showing you a selection, very, very brief selection. And you have many photographs in the book. For example, this is a site where there was an immense tree nursery. The Germans tried to import German fruit trees into Anatolia because they thought Turkish fruit trees were absolutely degenerated and primitive, and that they needed to be renewed. So it was kind of thinking that was on the level of, on a genetic level, basically, interfering into the country. And nowadays, this territory is, you can still read in the nature there that it was something once, some structure, but nature took over again. It's a pretty wild territory where you see that the old structures have been overgrown, let's say. So photographs like these were important, or findings like these were important for me to deal with this, with these ghosts that history left there and the contemporary state of relations there. I also went to sites where there were had been archaeological diggings and tried to document the way the earth has been touched there. It's really about what kind of traces of gestures do I find, exploitation, carelessness, or the opposite, or something in between. Here, a site very close to the Syrian border, where you see how some things have just been left there because they seemed not important enough, and a lot of garbage is lying in this kind of wound in the earth, right? Just some leftover hole. And then I also looked for moments where people, where some kind of strange creation was going on around the railway, some kind of unexpected and playful changing, rearranging of things. These are private gardens along the railway in the Taurus Mountains. And you can see that people used old railway tracks from German, made from German steel. And those materials are used here to build up a shed, like a terrace, a wine growing construction, where you can sit in the summer and enjoy the afternoon. Amazing how people let the material take over somehow and give unexpected uses to it. Here you see a rail track, an old German rail track, just reaching out into trees, and something is attached to it and holding something else again and helping plants to grow. And what is interesting in these gardens, I was studying the gentle gestures that people were applying in these gardens, in these private gardens, that were very, in my view, very contradicting to the gestures of efficiency that I had found documented in the letters. So here you can see all kinds of support structures that people came up with, holding something from underneath, pulling something slightly to the side or up. Gentle interventions, let's call them, that were executed with a great understanding for the actual moment, for the local detail, which I thought was important and something totally missing in the files. The authors of the files obviously never cared about the local detail. They never asked for it. They also never let themselves be touched by it. They are always writing out of the perspective of knowing better already and not having to look closely, something like that. Right? Here you see another moment, maybe some of you Italian farmers are really good in this too, I know. I studied some Italian gardens on former trips through Italy, but here you see a moment where plants are being held up. It's tomato plants by a system of strings and cords that are loosely attached to the plants, and the plants still have a lot of freedom to move around. And it's systems and structures like that which I then take up in works, and now I am at the third level of the research or of the work. The first was the study in the archives, the second is the trips, the travels, and the third level is the actual work in the studio, as an in the strict sense of the term, as an artist. And so I take up structures like these and try to translate them into properly pretty unexpected media. In this case, I made paintings about those structures that hold the tomatoes. Drawings and paintings came out of it, where I'm trying to grasp some sense of this movement and quality of relationships which exist in the in this very open structure. Here's a drawing from that series, preparatory drawing. So you, just to give you an idea that I try to develop a kind of an abstract understanding of the situation. In this case, it's really a view from above on the tomato field, looking from the air onto it, understanding the linear structure in there and the movements of plants, and as a kind of a map. Instead of wanting to use a map to control something, I just want to suggest that the person who drew the map is in love with the situation or has a very passionate relationship to that careful movement of those plants and the touchings that are happening within. There is a series of objects I developed where I was taking up the gestures I found in the gardens. Just an example here. Very simple executions that were all done in a short time and never worked upon again. No formalization or no perfectionism in the form. I was trying to have these simple executions that people can still, that you can still understand how they came about. And then these materials are brought together, both the research materials and the works, paintings, drawings, objects, in installations, in an installational context. As you can see here, it's a detail. You can't see that the space is actually much higher. It is the Heidelberger Kunstverein in Heidelberg in Germany, the art hall. And it was a very high space, and I constructed this structure to hold the archival part in a very loose way, stuck into the space. So when you were walking by, it was actually shaking. It was simply very breakable and loose, suggesting that this whole research presenting, which is being presented on it, is not a finite result. It's open for interpretation and to be worked on. And drawings and sculptures and paintings are in a dialogue with this in the space. You can see that in other moments in the installation, I'm trying to take up elements that I found in actual life. Like the moment of the strings in the tomato garden was taken up here to hold an archival structure in a very tall space. You see the strings that are holding the pole, the metal pole, and in the background, an object hanging on the wall. And then there's also a part in those installations that has vitrines that contain historical documents, which archives give me original documents. In this case, it were some original documents from Deutsche Bank archive, which I was really happy about to have. And I'm juxtaposing them or putting them next to objects that I am the author of, and mix those spheres. And a second medium is, besides the installations, is lecture performances, where I try to narrate the context, the historical context, and my own considerations about it in a longer story mixed with images, projections, video projections, and sculptural actions that I execute in front of the audience. Why I was showing you these images of the work is because the book that came out now contains all those levels. It is, on the one hand, a material collection, which you can really use to study the historical facts of the German economic penetration into the Ottoman Empire. You have a lot of written sources quoted here and a lot of black and white historical photographs that I picked. So pages with photographs, pages with historical files, but you have also at the same time a catalog of my work. So the works, the depictions of the works are scattered over the book throughout the book. Images of installations, images of lecture performances, and close-ups of single works. I also wrote two new lecture performances. They are longer texts written by myself, which are also published in the book. And the rest of the book are four wonderful contributions by authors. And in the case of Sabit Buchmann, it is a conversation between Sabit and me that has been printed in the book. Sabit. So maybe you want to finally take part in this.
So, yeah, thank you, Judith, for that really very instructive introduction in your work. And I guess that it became really very clear to the audience the structure of your whole project, the many layers you were providing us to us here. And for me, it's interesting that I'm right now with you in the situation to extend our conversation, which is going on since a while. For now, I would say like 3 or 4 years that we have meeting up and have been talking about your work again and again, and it's every time again new observations I can make, and it's always fresh perspectives I get on your work. Right now, what I would like to talk with you about, what does it mean for you right now after we have seen the way you were gathering your materials, you were doing your research, you were approaching the whole complex issue, via painting, which is, I think, a very, very specific way of access to a very political, complex phenomenon. And it's in the best sense a very, very good research, since it provides us with a specific chapter in German colonialism, as you has already mentioned, that Germany always insisted to never had this kind of involvement into the whole project of colonialism like Britain or France. That we see, of course, there was a really very brutal chapter within German history. And what you before have mentioned, that what one could see in what brutal way Germany were trying to get its profit out of this railway project. And for me right now, the question is, since you made very clear via the way you approach the whole phenomenon, that you always try to avoid that knowledge, yeah, and that rationality, that certain scientific methodology would be the only way to get access to this specific chapter of history and the way how we look right now at that region. And you have mentioned before, this is the region right now being in focus of global policies. So what does it mean after you were trying to find another way to do and to practice your research, to transform and to translate it into a book, since the book is much more a medium of knowledge, much more a medium of rationalization, much more a medium of discourse than your lecture performances, for instance, or your exhibitions were. So probably you can say some words on the challenge that has meant to you.
Mm. Well, I always knew that I wanted to publish these materials. I always knew that for me they are so striking and so unbelievably hard on us that they need to be out there. And this is the one part, right? To give a pretty complete overview over what I found and not miss too many details. This is why the book became so thick, because I really wanted to give a lot of resources. But then I always wanted to give it this richness of, and this tension of me walking between these worlds of researching in detail, but then of trying to loop it. And this is also some kind of obsession, right? And obsession can be brutal and violent at times. And what kind of other intensities can be there? And with what other material and other gestures do I fill the book next to this detailed research? And so it was, of course, important that drawings, details of drawings, of abstract watercolors, of objects find their way in the book, so that you start reading about things and you read in those letters that I picked a certain phenomenology. It's very phenomenological moments, how things and relationships were at the time, the quality of these relationships. And then you might, while browsing through the book, find some of a similar quality expressed in another language, the language of a watercolor, where something is suggesting a structure, suggesting control, but then the avoidance of control, structures that you find in the rhetorics of the letters, but then expressed in another language. Also the texts that I wrote, the contributions by the authors are something else again, but the texts I wrote are again operating in another way. They are, I don't want to sound strange, but I was trying to have them sound a bit poetic, that they are not mere research, mere historical facts that I'm telling. Also those texts entail historical research that I did, but they are more like fragments, one thought, one association following the other, some moments from interviews that I did with local people throughout my journeys, then again a quote from a philosopher that we all read these days. It's a mixture of things coming into the field. Yeah, so I think I hope I'm offering different doors to enter what is most important for me, which is the question, how do we touch things? I can talk about how we touch things. I can show it in something I have actually touched. I can show it in something that other people have touched. I can show it in the way I arrange all those findings, in the way I have touched the concept of the book. And I hope that even in these in this assembling of the pages, my designer and me, that we managed to keep something open and in the making, which is the most important, essentially.
The in the making, I think this is a good keyword to proceed our considerations about the way you bring in materials and practices. You were very often talking about gestures you were looking for, you were researching via your trips to Anatolia, Turkey. And this in the making is something that interests me in the form how people come into the picture, into the image. You show them how they do their farmings and how they improvise and what that actually meant to them to work in a very physical, under really very, very hard physical conditions. And by the same time, we see you in the image, like doing paintings, like doing photographs, like doing your lecture performances. So probably you can say a bit more about this in the making. This means that isn't already finished, it isn't already accomplished, but there is a process going on. And what does it mean in relation to your methodology?
I have never liked artworks that express some kind of exclusivity. It's a lot out there, I think, in the art world, that things are playing, structures are playing with the feeling that you should feel an admiration for what you see, and that you should feel that you can't touch it somehow, and that you have to remain in a distance. This kind of exclusivity that some structures around fine art can establish, and that some artworks also establish, I think, or work with, sometimes critically, but often not, I think. And I never liked this kind of feeling. My idea or my impulse, my first impulse, was always to try to work in a way that things seem rather, or not seem, are inclusive. That I suggest that things can be shared. This is one of the basic messages in what I do. If it is a painting, if it is a drawing, if it is a lecture, that I hope that things look and appear in a way that people feel they can share in and understand what's going on, and that it's not pretentious. Yeah, this was also at the core of my research, because what I found in the archives was pretentiousness, documented, being documented in history, in world history, right? German engineers, German bankers feeling better, thinking they do best, not sharing their knowledge necessarily with people who they met, right? I found a certain phenomenon which interests me in the art, mirrored or existent in social and economic history. And I wanted to work about this phenomenon, making it the topic and addressing it in every step I'm taking on the way, right? So also in my own means that I have.
And what strikes me a lot about this form of methodology you have chosen, that it can't be reduced to certain references, but that it is being to emerge kind of new images that can't be fit in, or that can't be filled in the whole picture of colonialism in a kind of coherent sense, that it are pictures which herausspringen, switch out of a certain continuity or coherence or a certain linearity, as you have said it. And in that sense, we could say it's a sort of allegorical procedure, like Walter Benjamin, for example, has described it, that there is something, there is an image you can't really put into the whole or can't reconstruct in a sense of a coherent narration. But there's always something which is special, which is a kind of surplus, which opens up new dimensions. But probably there's also some questions by the audience.
I would like to go back to the title of the book we haven't speak about. Ezer. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? Because it's so consistent to the place, and it's also very consistent to the way you decided to project the images. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us?
Yes, so we are basically sitting here, for those who listen to us and you can't see us, we are sitting on a terrace, and there is a part of the beautiful garden of the villa, and we are projecting into this garden. And in the way of the projection, there are also some trees growing, so the light is falling onto those trees and they throw their shadow onto the image on the screen. And Isa is something I found on the trip, on the way, when we were, I always traveled with my good friend İz Öztat, an artist from Istanbul who is Turkish and who always translated for me. And she and I, we were traveling to this site which I showed you before, where the Germans had this immense tree nursery, this school for trees, where they were planting 100,000 trees at a time. And we found an old man who had once worked in this territory, not at the German times anymore, but in the territory that followed German times, on this tree nursery. And he was an old gardener, and we talked to him, a Turkish man. The conversation with him was very special. He was a very gentle man with his own way of talking about things. And towards the end of the conversation, he named a tree Ezer. This is what İz, my friend, only pointed out to me later, that she said, I have to tell you, this was a special moment among other special moments. This man used the term Ezer, which is Turkish, and which means artwork or creation, to denounce a tree, to call a tree artwork, right? While talking about a tree in a general way. And this touched us both because, of course, and is in Turkish, in etymologically, it used to be in Old Turkish a word for something created by someone. So it was really the term for something made by someone, something that I'm fundamentally interested in. And then it turned later, shifted into this direction of an artwork. This connection with art, right? A notion of art or oeuvre. But he used it for a tree. And so I thought Ise is a good title for the book because the book or my research contains many levels of Ise or ideas of Ise. The German engineers would, of course, also have called their bridges and their tunnels Ise. And my artworks might be called, artworks in quotation marks, might be called Ise. But then also Ise's in the sense of the tree are in the book. So that's why I chose the title. It has this hybrid meaning.
May I ask you something else? We met you the first time many years ago during a symposium called Alternative Readings, do you remember? Mm. And at that time you were presenting another very long-lasting project that was the Pristina Art Library. So it seems to me that all your works, it's also a time, also about time, the time you dedicate to something, to a research. So I was thinking that maybe you have this, you're driven by the need of going in depth things. Otherwise, why would you deal for many, many years in such a long endeavor, such a long venture in archives, field trips, all these long translation works, and it's so demanding. I was also interested in this, how do you work?
Yeah, I guess I am
obsessed.
It's just that I get so interested in the things I find out, and they are so, and I take them so serious, and they have such a complexity that I guess other ways of working would be to single out at an earlier point a few moments you want to work on and not work in such a broad way. I am always keeping, this is usually my way, now it was in these two projects that you're mentioning, that I'm keeping up a few issues at the same time that interest me equally. And that makes it broad and that makes it also long, because if you want to pay tribute, like if you want to deal with this in a serious way, it simply takes a long time. Yeah, I don't like quick jokes so much in the art, I must admit.
Yeah, it seems clear.